Good morning, it's great to be back. I think we'll have some slides coming up in a minute. If we can change the input on that, that'd be great. I've noticed there's a couple of themes we've got in common. One is chocolate, and the other is the Beatles. You'll have to wait a little bit longer to find out what I mean about the Beatles. But as Peter will know, that when I have lectured in church history, what I normally do is have an ongoing chocolate quiz. And we'll ask four multiple choice questions each lesson. And the person at the end of the semester with the most correct answers wins a kilogram of chocolate. Well, we don't have a whole semester here, although, mind you, I am trying to give you a semester's course in about 20 minutes. But there will be a chocolate theme. I'm going to ask you two questions of the same sort that I ask in the lectures. And I have my very good-looking assistant, my wife, Deborah. If you get questions right, you will actually get a chocolate prize. So when we're looking at coming here this morning, my kids were saying, you're going to give out chocolate in church, is that completely appropriate? So thank you for reassuring us that we're okay on that one. All right, so our first question, have I got turned that on? Not quite. Okay. Many of you would know people get canonized as saints in the Roman Catholic Church, and to do that you have to be associated with a miracle. And the question is, for what alleged miracle was Bernard canonized as saint? You have four options, A, B, C, and D. All you have to do is remember what letter you've committed to for two questions, and then be completely honest, of course, at the end of this. Okay, so option A. While he was adoring a statue of Mary, its breasts dripped milk onto his lips. These are highly visual, by the way. B, while he was adoring a statue of John the Baptist that poured water on his head. C, while he was adoring a statue of Jesus, it bled onto his hands. Or D, while he was adoring a statue of Samson, it hit him in the head with a donkey jawbone. So make your mental commitments, people. Okay? Make your mental commitments here. All right. Lock in your answers, you know. It's not fair to say I think it's B or C. Commit, all right? Okay. Next question. So there's only two of these for the sake of time. Now, relics. Who knows what a relic is? Okay, and yeah, all right. You're one. Does anyone else know what a relic is? Yes. It's a bit of a saint who died, or perhaps an item associated with them. Thank you for that. So the next question is, what alleged relic kept in Canterbury, England, did the medieval church claim was the oldest relic in the world? I beg your pardon? The Holy Grail. Okay. Not one of the options, Paul, I'm afraid. Option A, the club with which Cain killed Abel. Option B, the apple core from which Adam and Eve took bites. Option C, a splinter of bone from Adam's rib. Or option D, the clay that God had left over after making Adam. Now, I have to admit that apart from asking these questions in my church history classes and bribing students unashamedly with the promise of a kilogram of chocolates, part of my agenda in this is to convince people church history is fun. And church history is full of bizarre people, maybe even slightly more bizarre than you and I. Okay, so think of your option. Do you have to, by the way, I hope you haven't forgotten what you locked in as your letter for the first one. Okay, in the hilarity over some of these options here. So you've got both your letters, all right, locked in. And I'll tell you the answers. So for the first one, the correct answer was, while he was adoring a statue of mercy, its breasts dripped milk onto his lips. Now, I have to be completely honest with you here. You know, this visual image that's conjured up here. If I personally were constructing a list of people who were likely candidates for canonisation, the guy lurking with his lips so close to the breast of a statue would probably not be at the top of the list. So to ease my mind over this, I actually had to do some further research, and I discovered Bernard is in the clear. This was actually a projectile lactation. Okay, he was much further back, so you know. All right, so can I ask you, who, if anybody, got two right? Oh, I haven't told you that. Okay. D, sorry. The clay God had left over after making Adam. Did anyone get two right? Okay, can we pass? You don't. I know you've been there before, but he still should get two. He's remembered them, you know? Okay, who got one right? Keep your hands up, please, and my gorgeous assistant will get to you in due... Whoa, this is half the congregation. Okay, I'll keep going because we're on a tight timeline, but you'll see the other theme, the Beatles, coming up a bit later on. Okay, there are perennial questions. We flagged these last time if you were here. Questions like, what is the church and where and who is the authority? For much of this Middle Age period, these questions were settled. We saw a fair bit of tumult in the early church period. And for the hundreds of years that we're looking at in this medieval period, really the institutional church personified in the Pope was really the ultimate authority. Also, after the fall of the Roman Empire, one writer has said that really the church was the cement or the mortar that held civilization together for the next 1,000 years. If you thought in terms of education, health, welfare, etc., anything happening, it was basically the church doing it. And one of the other key themes, which we won't terribly agree with as people in the 21st century, they defined unity really as something that had to have the elements of uniformity and unanimity to it. If you disagreed in any way, then unity ceased to exist. Now, I put this slide up earlier in the previous session just to show these are the general dates of periods of church history. We're obviously looking at the second one at the moment. And these aren't just dates chosen at random. They're dates in which really there are substantial political, theological worldview changes going on. So you need to, I think I made this disclaimer before in the previous session, this is going to be superficial and inadequate. So I'm setting the bar low and hoping to, you know, to get there, because we're trying to deal with a vast period of time, a whole semester's worth at least of material in about 20 minutes or thereabouts. Okay. Every level of society gets affected by these worldview changes. And for much of the Middle Ages, the role of the institutional church is now something that's unquestioned and a considerably expanded view. But as the church becomes more institutional, the question starts to arise, in that context, what can individuals do to pursue God? Now, one of the things we didn't touch on last time, so we'll backtrack just a little, is the role of asceticism, not to be confused with aestheticism. They're almost opposites, really. Who knows what an ascetic is? Any takers at the back? Someone who's living in the desert? A guy in the pole in the desert. I've got a picture of him. Next slide. Well done. Okay. So ascetics are people who are really living lives of self-denial. And in the early church period, the ultimate Christian heroes were martyrs. Okay, you remember there were several periods, about 10 periods of persecution. But after the conversion of Constantine in the early 4th century and the later adoption of Christianity as the official religion of the Roman Empire, people weren't martyred in quite the same way. For many people, this had been, I'm not being completely facetious, a career option. I want to die for Jesus. In fact, there are cases recorded of parents who had to hide their son's clothes so that they couldn't race out into the street with the I love Jesus, please kill me t-shirt, because they were literally wanting to race out and die for their faith. No longer a career option. This devastated many people for whom martyrdom was the highest calling of all. Now, there'd always been ascetics. St. Anthony is one of the notable early examples, who in a Monty Python moment, of which there are many in church history, went out to live in the desert to be alone. God and me, God and me, God and me. Nobody else. And he did that so successfully that one morning he stuck his head out of the cave and there were a couple of hundred people wanting to follow him. Okay. So, a bit annoying really. He also lived to be 120 years of age and on a diet of bread, salt and water. So what your mother told you about vegetables isn't completely true. But people could no longer die physically for their faith, no longer martyrs, so what they did was moved increasingly into this realm of asceticism where they could die in another way, die to self, a life of self-denial. Those of you who were here last time remember us talking about Gnosticism, this idea of dualism between spirit and flesh, obviously drives some of this. Unfortunately, though, this path can lead to a path of self-obsession, and in some cases, insanity. Our friend on the pole, this is a very sanitized image, because you can imagine if you live on a pole for quite some number of years and never come down, and have food handed up to you on a pole and never come down, there are some sanitary challenges. So, yes, he did live up there, surrounded and sitting in his own excreta, and covered in maggots. But of course, this was the best way to God at the time. Definitely a cleaned up image. You can see the snake down the bottom. Removed from the earth is the idea. Removed from temptation. People would come to hear him preach, but obviously didn't stand too close to the pillar. Now, in time, asceticism moved into a new form of expression, monasticism, something we'd be familiar with from movies and books. This really was a community of ascetics, recognising that solitude wasn't completely healthy. And in monasticism, the same as asceticism, life was seen as this dynamic struggle between good and evil. It required constant vigilance, constant discipline. And it also was an expression that recognised there are benefits here in accountability, community, mentoring, etc. Now, monasticism brings with it advantages and disadvantages. We'll look at the advantages first. One of the key ones for us is the preservation of manuscripts. Before the printing press arrived in the middle of the 15th century, who were the people copying everything by hand? These guys. Okay? We owe them a great debt. Also, as the monastic communities developed, they provided an outlet for charity to the sick and the poor. They promoted scholarship and education. And in many cases, spiritual path through life, they also, their very existence was a reproof to worldliness that was often exhibited in the institutional church. And later on, they led to missionary outreach. Many of the later Roman Catholic missionaries came from monasteries. There were, however, some disadvantages. One is that they could present a false dualism, which reflects Gnosticism, that everything is about spirit, everything physical is bad. They could lead to eccentricity and despair, and also to dual standards. If you were a real Christian, you would go into monastic life. You would become a monk, you would become a nun, something like that. So there is first class and economy class Christians, if you like. It could also lead to something of an obsession with your own personal salvation, your personal spiritual life, that could eclipse a concern for the world. And linked with that is you could see monasticism as taking some of the best men and women out of society. Here's a picture of a key guy, Benedict of Nursia, who had a strong influence on monasticism. We've got a Benedictine monastery, of course, at New Norcia, not terribly far away from Perth. A guy who came from a wealthy family. Rome shocked him. Lived in a cave for years, as you do. I think it was the equivalent of a bachelor's degree in theology at the time. Became very popular, and then someone tried to kill him. And then he started his own monastery, a place called Monte Cassino. Now, Under Benedict, and the Benedictine rule became something of a model. This was where monks couldn't own their own property, shared meals, avoided unnecessary conversation, etc. And the day was divided into compartments. There's a prayer compartment, a study compartment, a manual labour compartment, etc. Now, while monasticism is going on, backtracking just a bit to our previous period, Rome and the Bishop of Rome was busy becoming the Pope. Rome was the capital, of course, of the empire before it fell, and was seen, therefore, as the preeminent city. Constantinople obviously would beg to differ, because Constantinople being the eastern capital of the Roman Empire under Constantine, and of course named after Constantine, saw themselves pretty much on a par with Rome. However, back to relics, Rome was the place where traditionally both Peter and Paul died. So their relics, their bodies, are in Roman soil. That, in the thinking of the time, gave Rome part of its claim to apostolicity and preeminence. We saw last time church councils often disagreed, and therefore it was good in a sense to have someone who had the power of veto, somebody who had the final say on matters of doctrine, etc. And so that gravitated again towards the Bishop of Rome and his power. And the church itself, having been adopted by the empire, started to mirror the institutional hierarchical structure of the Roman Empire. And finally, not long before Rome falls, there's this image of Leo I, who was the Bishop of Rome, standing up to the barbarians, effectively, at the gate of Rome, and moving the Pope from purely a spiritual figure into more of a statesman-like political figure. There's a picture of him. Okay, in just before 600, the head of the church in the Eastern Empire, Constantinople, assumed the title of universal bishop. This didn't go down terribly well in Rome, as you can see. It was regarded as less than a good thing to do. Pope Gregory, who was pope at the time, liked those titles. Servant of servants, vicar of Christ, successor of Peter. Vicar, of course, is someone who most of us probably are familiar with the term from Vicar of Dibley, if nothing else, but really means someone who stands in the place of someone else. Now, in practice, in many places except for the East, the primacy of the Roman bishop was being accepted. It was quite widely accepted at the start of the medieval period. The Celtic Church, we're about to talk about in just a second. But there were growing tensions between the East and Western churches over many, many years that led to them eventually splitting in the middle of the 11th century. Some of these tensions started with the difference between Latin and Greek. The West was adopting Latin as its language of educated language and language of theological discussion, whereas the Greek was still being spoken in the East. That led to some genuine theological misunderstandings in that area. We've got the whole thing happening between Rome and Constantinople. How equal to Rome is Constantinople? There were issues over idols and uses of statues and images in worship during the Middle Ages. And ultimately, they anathematized each other. Good word, isn't it? Anathematized. In 1054. And I've got reference 1965 in brackets there, because that's how long it took before the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople and the then Pope of the Roman Catholic Church actually removed those anathemas on each other. They still, of course, didn't reunite as bodies, as denominations, but there was something like a 900-year anathema standing there for some time. Back to our friends the Celts. Okay, Celtic culture was pre-Christian, flourished obviously in places like Ireland and Scotland, and across much of Europe. And when Christianity came to the British Isles, the Celtic culture was obviously there, and they had an existing strong focus on creation. This is something that flies in the face of some of the Gnostic influences that were there on early Christianity. When the Celts accepted Christianity, like we all do, what they previously believed, their existing culture, affected and influenced what they took from Christianity and their resulting theology. St. Ninian is the first Christian Celt that we're really aware of, around about 400. Now, some of the distinctives of the Celtic society, and this becomes really a grassroots expression of Christianity that is distinct from the institutional Roman Catholic Church. I was more nomadic than urban, liked the monastic model, didn't like this Roman model with an emphasis on bishops. They did their pastoral care from the abbeys and monasteries. They didn't actually want to be ordained by Roman bishops. This led to some problems. And because of their previous understanding, they had a strong sense of the immanence, the presence, the activity of God in nature, rather than this Gnostic influenced idea that God's up there, he's transcendent, he's got nothing to do with us because he's too holy to have that. But they still managed to blend that with asceticism, and they were strongly critical of the increasing wealth and luxurious pursuits they saw in the Roman Catholic Church. They were strongly missionary as well. Now, in the middle of all this, by the way, there's a showdown at a place called Whitby in the 60s, in which officially the Roman Catholic Church triumphed over the Celtic view of theology. But Celtic theology lived on for quite some time, and there's been quite a rediscovery of it in the last few decades. Rise of Islam. Okay. Muhammad, of course, they're the five pillars of Islam. There's only one God. Muhammad is his prophet. You have to do a pilgrimage to Mecca if you possibly can. Zakat is a tax, a small tax that you paid. The regular daily prayer and fasting are the five pillars. And Islam rose in the 7th century and therefore was a major force at the beginning of the Dark Ages. I should just explain Dark Ages and Middle Ages, overlapping terms. Dark Ages at the beginning of the Middle Ages and ending before the Middle Ages themselves end. A couple of different views of thought on when the Dark Ages themselves do end. And this, the Dark Ages refers to the lack of literacy, essentially, in that early period of the Middle Ages after Rome falls to the barbarians. There's a mini Renaissance under a guy called Charlemagne around about 800, and then the universities, as we'll see, arrive around about 1100, which really puts the nail in the coffin of the Dark Ages at that point. The church under Islam, which was very much a military-focused movement as well, lost a lot of its original territory. We'll see a map in a minute, to Islam. And at a decisive battle called the Battle of Tours, if you Google 10 decisive battles in world history, this will be on the list. Basically, having taken over Spain, the Islamic forces were rising up into France, and they were defeated at that point. And although Spain remained influenced by Islam for quite some time, the guy who was at the head of those forces that defeated Islam, his name was Martel. And the French paid him the ultimate compliment. Today, if you go into Liquorland, you can still buy Martel cognac. Okay. Named after this guy. Okay, why did Islam spread so quickly? A couple of quick points. One thing was Muhammad himself misunderstood some key points of Christian doctrine. Didn't like the Trinity, for example. Thought that the Trinity was God the Father, God the Son, and Mary, God's girlfriend. At this time, both the Eastern and the Western empires were weak. The citizens were overtaxed, so there was discontent there. There was quite some initially cordial relationships between Jews and Muslims, where the Christians weren't treating the Jews that well. And Islam fused political, religious and military interest into a whole. When Islam took over an area, they gave people a triple choice. You could become a Muslim and pay a very small amount of taxation. You could stay a non-Muslim and carry the burden of the taxation for that area, but you couldn't talk about your faith. Or if you wanted to keep your original faith and talk about it, you could die. They were the three choices. And a lot of people felt that they could somehow move Islam into their existing belief system. And so there was a fair bit of what's called syncretism going on, meshing of beliefs. Okay. Now you can see there that tan area is really, this is just after the Battle of Tours, where you can see they're not really in France anymore, but that tanned area is the extent of geographical Islam in the middle of the 8th century. Okay, seven sacraments. I'll do a quiz here if we have time. We don't really.
We do,
yeah. We do? Oh, I'm conscious of...
We knew you were a long speaker.
Okay, my reputation precedes me.
Okay. Girls, just need a couple of minutes to finish.
So yeah, that's right. I've still got a bit to go.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. For many of the early years of the Middle Ages, there wasn't much serious theology being done. This resurfaces in the 12th century with a guy called Peter Lombard, whose book Sentences really is the first clarification of what became the seven sacraments of the Roman Catholic Church, which are... Okay, most of those are self-explanatory. Extreme unction, who knows what that is? Sorry, can't quite hear it. Okay, prayers for the dying, sometimes called last rites. So that's one, and Eucharist, of course, communion. So most of the others are pretty self-explanatory. But this obviously is a system that carries you from the cradle to the grave. What had been happening over quite some time is that also these sacraments are really only done by an ordained Roman Catholic priest. And they are all really external things that the priest does. So over a period of time, bit of a generalisation, but probably with a lot of truth to it, for a lot of people, the faith that they had was something that was expressed externally. Way back in the early church period, when there's a period of persecution, one of the things they argued about was whether or not the sacraments that have been performed by a priest who later... turns away from the faith, or actually valid, or are they retrospectively annulled, if you like? And the church decided that they were, in fact, remain valid because God was working through them, which led to a bit of an automatic understanding of the sacraments. But you can imagine the dilemma. So you get married, you have seven kids, 10 years later the priest who married you backslides, suddenly your marriage is illegitimate, and as are your children. Okay? You don't want to be in that situation, so the church went the other direction and said, no, God is moving, and regardless of the character or subsequent character of the priest. So it tended to externalise people's relationship with God. It was also a very powerful weapon for the Pope. The Pope had at his disposal something called the interdict, which meant he could ban all those happening in any country he chose, and on occasion did so. Think about that for a minute. You get a bit offside with England and you slap an interdict on England. That means there is no marriage, there is no prayers for the dying, there is no ordination. The country is just going to hell in a handbasket, okay? Until you change your mind, basically. Very powerful weapon, and the Pope used it on occasion. Okay, the role of relics. We've talked about them. You know the oldest relic in the world. Okay, you know what they are. There's lots of them. Some people have said that if you gather together all the splinters of the true cross that are in existence in Europe, you would actually be able to reconstruct Noah's Ark from the fragments. We've commented on the fact that the Pope's power, seated in Rome, was largely due to the fact that Peter and Paul's relics were there. Charlemagne, who was an emperor in the 9th century, had a throne with lots of little cavities in it that were stashed with, I don't know, Peter's toenails or something, because it was seen as power. This was a link to power. And the concept of papal indulgences began based on this. Now, big word there, supererogation, which is not, excuse the joke I've used over and over and over again, is not a really good way of watering your garden. Okay? Supererogation is the idea that the saints have done so much more than can be expected of them. There's some sort of treasury of merit in heaven. Most people are going to die and go to purgatory in Roman Catholic theology and spend an awful long time in purgatory, maybe a couple of million years. Okay, if you're baptised, you'll go to heaven, but eventually, okay, you spend time in purgatory getting purged of the sins that you committed. Okay, but not, of course, if you're a saint. You leap straight over the boundary, and probably clear it by 500 metres or so. The gap can be re-diverted into this treasury of merit and re-diverted to you and me, who probably don't want to spend 2 million years in purgatory. And what about great Aunt Agnes, who died last week, and we know a few things about that particular skeleton there in the closet, literally and metaphorically. So great Aunt Agnes, we know, is going to spend a lot of time in purgatory, all right? But we don't want that for great Aunt Agnes, so what do? We need to sort of somehow short-circuit, get some wires between the treasury of merit and Aunt Agnes, and make a circuit there and get her out of purgatory sooner. Okay, so the idea was linked often to relics. So if you viewed relics on a certain holy day and paid a certain amount of money, you'd get a certificate saying Agnes gets 10 years off purgatory or something like that. Or you, or any other person that you might nominate. Okay, where are we? This is still very much part of Roman Catholic theology, by the way. Pope John Paul II, just before 2000, in the lead up to the new millennium, was issued an indulgence and said that people can get an indulgence if you do something like giving up smoking for the day or something like that. I'm not quite sure how the Vatican keeps track of the paperwork, but it's still part of the thinking there. Okay, Crusades. There were lots of them, seven or eight of them, went over a period of about 200 years. They started in 1095 with a guy called Pope Urban, who instigated the First Crusade. The initial impulse was because it was becoming dangerous for pilgrims to go to Jerusalem. They'd been able to do it for many years, but now it was becoming increasingly dangerous, so the idea was, let's get Jerusalem back. Only the First Crusade briefly succeeded in doing that. The others were all abject failures. There's eyewitness accounts from the First Crusade. One particular guy said, I can't tell you what happened in the First Crusade in Jerusalem. If I told you everything, you wouldn't believe it, he said, but we were riding through the Temple of Jerusalem, as in riding on horses, and the blood was flowing up to the horses' bridles. Okay, there were pyramids of heads and hands and feet in the city of Jerusalem. It was completely beyond belief, which indicates, obviously, that. And the Crusades created a permanent barrier between Christians and Muslims. Many of you would know that a derogatory term that Muslims use of Christians today is Crusader. Okay, and raised some serious theological questions, which we'll look at in just a second. Picture for you to look at for a minute. Incidentally, the Crusades were where modern taxation comes from. The idea of taxing people, not just landowners, but pretty much everybody, came out of the need to finance the Crusades. So you might want to have a theological objection to the ATO the next time they ask you to pay something. Okay. One of the big questions that this raised, whose side is God on? Okay. The Christians lost. The Muslims won. Does that mean Christianity is wrong? How can we fight for God and still lose? Isn't God all-powerful? And finally, there was this grudging acceptance that Islam wasn't going away, and that led to other ways of dealing with it, including missions eventually. And one of the other interesting things, particularly for our next period in the Reformation, the Crusaders brought back books. Now, the West, remember, had been going through the Dark Ages. Okay. The rate of literacy was very low. In a conference in 1215, they were complaining about how many of the clergy were still illiterate. So if there was a problem with clergy literacy in 1215, you can imagine what the general literacy level was like. But they not only brought back scholars, they brought back people who could read the books, which is handy. So this gives an impetus to Greek speaking, Greek studies, and obviously, therefore, the link into Greek thought. Universities rise in this time, the late 1100s. First one was in Bologna in Italy. Definitely ends the Dark Ages. They're founded in cities, and the cities obviously that have universities get bigger still, so it contributes to rising urbanisation. If you were studying in a university, you'd start off. Now, this is a time when if you live to be 40 years old, you're probably doing quite well. So you'd spend 7 years in university on your first degree doing liberal arts. If you wanted to do some real study, then you'd do another 7 years because that would, you know, be medicine, law, or theology, right? That's the real stuff. 14 years of a life of 40, well, you're probably going to university around about 14 to accommodate that. The church was obviously a a major way into that. Urban life increases. Virtually all the early scholars are ordained, and these gradually replace the monasteries as the centres of learning. Three more slides to go. Congratulations on hanging in there, by the way. Hopefully the chocolate that most of you are munching has led to some endorphin production and you're going okay. All right. Rise of the friars. The old medieval model of what churches did, which was plonk a church down in the middle of a rural parish, and the priest of the church knew everybody in that parish, knew who was about to have a baby, who was about to die, all that sort of stuff. Cities completely blow that away. And the church didn't have a good model to meet the new urban life, which led to the rise of the friars, the Franciscans and the Dominicans, who were tailored to that. They're both named after their founders, Dominic and Francis. And they had a lifestyle of simplicity. Teaching was important to them, therefore schools were important to them. And they were what's known as mendicant orders, which meant they lived by begging. They became famous around times of great calamity, the Black Death, which there were several plagues, of course, in Western Europe. The big one being in the middle of the 14th century, took out anywhere between 30% and 50% of the population of Western Europe. So it was incredibly devastating. Most people just ran away if they had the money to leave town. The friars were actually there ministering to people who were dying, putting their own life at peril. The Monty Python moment in this is, of course, these guys have taken a vow of poverty. So when people died, what did they do? They were so generous, so grateful to the friars, they left the money in their will. Okay? You just can't win sometimes, can you? You know, try to live in a cave by yourself with God, doesn't happen because you get popular. Try to live a life of poverty, doesn't happen because people appreciate you so much they decide to make you rich. This is the link to the Beatles theme, for those of you who will pick it up. Okay. The friars are still with us, of course. Okay. For those of you who haven't picked that up, that's obviously linked to the Abbey Road album. Okay, couldn't resist putting that in there. Okay, last slide coming up. As we get towards the end of the Middle Ages, we hit something called the Renaissance. There's big links between this and the next stage, which is the Reformation. The term Renaissance literally means rebirth. Many of you would be well aware of this term because it cuts across all aspects of culture, art and literature and music, etc. It's partly fueled by the rediscovery of Greek classic writing and what the Crusaders brought back in terms of scholars and books is doubled or more when Constantinople, which is held out against the forces of Islam for several hundred years, finally falls in 1453. People could see it was going to fall, so there's an exodus of scholars and books to the West. Just briefly, a guy called Aristotle had an emphasis on particulars. If you compared a piece of art or a painting that was done in the Middle Ages to something that was done in the Renaissance period, the later Middle Ages. Who's seen Michelangelo's David? You've seen pictures of the statue. You might have seen the statue in real life. You know, if you look closely at the hands, you can see veins, right? Someone gives me a chisel, a hammer, and a piece of marble. If I got something vaguely resembling a human being out of it, I would be elated. Okay, forget veins. But this guy was cutting open corpses and watching people cut open corpses because he was so detail conscious. There was a rise in interest in details, and therefore coming out of that, a rise in emphasis on the individual that comes out of the Renaissance and leads into our next period, which we'll talk about when I come back next time. If you looked at a piece of art or sculpture, let's say a crucifixion picture in the early Middle Ages, probably just Jesus would be in sharp relief. The two people on the crosses on either side would be hazy and the crowd would just be almost in complete shadow. There was less of an interest in the overall details and specifics come out at this particular time. Okay, portraits, individuals, they become common. Again, popes become art collectors in this stage. Okay, and art sponsors, for which we can be grateful in retrospect, but in many cases it meant that they were a bit more focused on some of these things and perhaps leading the church in a spiritual way. And fascination with the original languages, something called humanism comes out of this particular period, and more on that when we talk about the Reformation. I have officially finished. As I said, superficial, inadequate, there it is. But if we've got a couple of minutes, I'm happy to field any questions and try to bluff my way through them. Thank you.
What's Constantinople?
Istanbul.
Istanbul.
Mm. Yep.
The picture of Leo, he's going like this.
Okay. You think he's been at a rock concert?
I reckon, like, is that the...
I didn't even notice.
Okay. Okay. You
maybe he was into heavy metal, I'm not sure.
Hey. Okay.
Cool.
When did Constantinople fall?
1453.
Having that to do the Reformation?
It depends. This congregation sort of votes, and if they don't like me, you will be stuck in the Middle Ages forever. Okay, no more questions. Then I think I'm done. Yeah. Thank you.